Arizona's attorney general wants one of the state's utility regulators out of office. And he's pretty confident in his case.
This isn't one of these instances where this was maybe somebody skating too close to a line or maybe somebody that had gone into a gray area. I think the law is very clear on this case.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, AZ merit results are out, who did well, who didn't, and what needs to happen next. A Phoenix company is accused of misleading Chinese investors. And our architecture series in a place, this time with a sense of scale.
It's small enough and intimate enough that you can really kind of tell, you know, even from the street, like, wow, there's something fantastic going on here.
Plus, using technology to capture carbon dioxide after it's already been released, and Phoenix works on making it easier for some downtown businesses to sell booze. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Checking traffic quickly, I-10 eastbound. The exit ramp at 59th Avenue is restricted. Elsewhere, the 202 Santan Freeway northbound, a crash at Elliott has the shoulder blocked. Look for sunny skies today with a high of 64 degrees. Continue cooler than average. 69 is average for today. Clear skies for tonight. Cool with a low of 40 overnight. Mostly sunny skies for both tomorrow and Thursday. Warming up a bit as well with highs of 70 tomorrow, 75 by Thursday. Right now in Phoenix, it's 58 degrees at KJZZ. An effort aimed at recalling Arizona's top schools official has reached a roadblock. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the group collecting signatures is far short of its goal, with only a month left to gather them.
The Coalition to Recall Diane Douglas reports it has collected less than 100,000 names. It needs nearly 370,000 by December 30th to force a recall election for the superintendent of public education. The recall petition cites Douglas's feud with the State Board of Education and says she's focused on power rather than on students and school performance. The coalition's chairman, Max Goschert, says the group's volunteers will continue to collect signatures in hopes of reaching their goal. A Douglas spokesman says she hasn't been following the recall effort. She's instead focused on supporting teachers, students, and schools. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Department of Education released a school breakdown of AZ merit standardized test scores yesterday. Marks vary widely among public schools around the state. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan takes a look at two schools on opposite ends of the achievement spectrum.
Coolidge Unified in Pinal County is a district of 3,500 kids that stretches over 1,000 square miles. Less than 25% of its students got passing scores on the AZ merit test. Superintendent Sherry Wallace isn't surprised. The district has been getting school improvement assistance from the state for the 3 years she's been there. She believes better teaching is one of the keys to improved scores.
And I don't think that's unique to Coolidge. I believe that elementary teachers don't get the training, the deep understanding of math content.
Teachers at the district, which switched to a four-day week this year, are now taking one Friday a month to get training.
A lot of secondary teachers do have a deep understanding of their content, their math content, but haven't been taught instructional strategies.
Nearly 80% of Coolidge students are on free or reduced lunch, and teacher turnover has historically been high. But Wallace says since the four-day week schedule, retention is now above 80%. Educational Services Director Laura Neville with the Kyrene School District in the East Valley also believes teachers are a major component to student success on these exams.
One of the things that we've worked on in our district is to add additional contract days for teachers to meet when kids aren't present.
She says this time is important for teachers to evaluate how students are grasping the new standards. This year, more than 70% of kids at the Kyrene de la Sierra Elementary School got passing scores on AZ merit math and English tests.
We know where we're going, and we are being very methodical about how to help kids move through the learning progression to get where they need to be.
Neville says part of the school's success is that teachers aggressively changed their teaching to meet new standards adopted by the Board of Education in 2010. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
To get more of a sense of what teachers think of the scores and how they can be improved, we turn now to Joe Thomas. He teaches high school social studies in Mesa and is also vice president of the Arizona Education Association.
We knew the test scores would be lower and in the first year, and we know that we're going to build from there. This first year kind of gives us a baseline of where our students are relative to the new standards and the new assessment, and we're hoping to make progress every year from here.
How do you think that the state should go about building from here? I mean, what can the state do? What can schools and teachers do?
Well, everybody has their role and their responsibility, and these test scores really tell more than just the story of how the students are doing. They're telling about what the state is doing and what educators are doing. And so we have to dig a little deeper than just the test score to understand that. So what the state can do is they can invest in our kids and give our kids a chance at doing better. What teachers can do is they can continue along the professional development line that they're on right now, learn more about the new standards, incorporate the new standards into their lessons, be creative with that, and push our students to succeed as we always have.
How long do you think is reasonable to expect sort of this figuring it out time before we'll sort of settle into where the scores are going to be?
As opposed to time, I would say that we need to worry about what we're focused on. We need to focus on reforms that work. We need to lower class size. We need to make sure that all students have access to full-day kindergarten. We need to make sure that schools have the resources they need to meet the speech and hearing needs of all of our students. We need to make sure that our students are ready academically to do well on these tests, and that requires an investment. If we're focused on the latest fad in education, if we're focused on areas that aren't going to impact teaching and learning, that's what's going to detract us from doing well on these tests.
Have you had to change how or specifically what you teach your students to get them ready for this kind of assessment?
Well, last year when we were really beginning to roll out the new standards at the high school level deeply and really incorporate that into our lessons, it is a lot more about critical thinking. It allows you to really get the students engaged in the subject matter at a deeper level. The difficulty with that, or the challenge with that, is that we were moving from a very kind of superficial facts and memorization component. That was the aims, that was the test we had, and it was a different type of learning. And so now I think educators use more writing, more reading across the entire curriculum. And that's going to be better for our students. It's going to promote critical thinking, but it is going to take a little bit for the students to get used to that and for the teachers to get used to that.
In your mind, is there anything that you see in these scores that points to something directly that should be happening now to sort of bring those up and get students ready to take the test next time?
We have to remember that this was the first year, and it's a reflection of where we are in a transition year from one mode of teaching to another mode of teaching, one set of standards to another set of standards. If we continue to see low test scores and we didn't see any movement moving forward, then I think we would really have to take a hard look at what is going on inside the classrooms. We have our first set of data, and we can look and see where what areas that we are having success in math and reading and writing, and what areas that we have a lot of growth in front of us. And I think that the next step towards this year and next year and every year afterwards is to make sure that we're bringing in the right professional development. Districts need to learn from each other on what's successful. These standards are nationwide, so we can learn from other states on what programs, what scheduling systems can be successful and promote more student learning, and we're going to have to be very reflective moving forward like that.
Joe Thomas is Vice President of the Arizona Education Association. Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
One of Arizona's top regulators could soon be out of a job. On Monday, Attorney General Mark Brnovich filed a petition with the state Supreme Court alleging Corporation Commission Chair Susan Bittersmith is violating conflict of interest rules and should be removed from office. Brnovich cites several ways Bittersmith's powers conflict with her lobbying for the cable industry. One is broadband. And as KJZZ's Will Stone explains, others are raising questions about her involvement in that area, too.
Between 2010 and 2013, Galen Updike was wrestling with a digital dilemma. While cities like Phoenix enjoyed readily available high-speed internet, the same was not true for rural communities.
Arizona was particularly hurt because our separation of connectivity was so much larger.
Updike was part of a team of state employees and consultants tasked with mapping the availability of broadband and devising policy recommendations to better connect the state. A prominent voice throughout the process, he says, was Susan Bittersmith, the director of a cable industry trade group.
The only reason for Bittersmith to be there was talk about telecommunication policy, broadband policy.
In November 2012, Bittersmith was elected to the Corporation Commission, the powerful regulatory body that oversees public utilities, including telephone services. In recent months, she's been under fire for being a lobbyist for Cox Communications and director of that cable association.
Nobody but nobody believes that these corporations are separate. When you get your bill from Cox at the end of the month, all the services are bundled. It comes through your house on one line.
That's attorney Tom Ryan, who filed the initial complaint with the attorney general. While it doesn't regulate cable or broadband, the commission does oversee the telephone side of companies like Cox and Suddenlink, which are members of Bittersmith's association and often bundle their internet, phone, and cable offerings. She has at times voted on matters relating to the telecom side of her members and at others abstained, but she disputes that her relationship with the industry violates the commission's conflict of interest rules.
Telephone entities of the cable world are separate corporate entities. They have separate identities, they have separate regulatory schemes, they have separate fees.
But others argue these distinctions don't hold up when Bittersmith has to make decisions about rates, policy, and issues that could impact companies in her association, which pays her a six-figure salary on top of her state one. And that's where broadband comes in. Interviews with Updike, others close to the broadband initiative, and public records indicate Bittersmith was working to influence state policy on behalf of her members while a candidate and after taking office. Here's Updike again.
She was consistently involved and a factor throughout 2012 in opposition of the state broadband plan.
He says, among other things, that plan highlighted how to remove government barriers to broadband in rural areas. And a challenge, Updike says, was major cable providers had little incentive to build out broadband because the return on investment is too low. That contention did not sit well with Bittersmith's Cable Association, though. A letter from her the day before she was elected spells out a handful of objections to the plan from the, quote, cable telecommunications industry, unquote. And after Bittersmith took office, emails obtained by KJZZ show she arranged a meeting at the beginning of April 2013 with representatives from Cox, CenturyLink, Cable One, AT&T, and the head of the agency in charge of the state's broadband initiative. The subject line reads, quote, meeting with Susan Bittersmith, re-telecommunications. In an interview with KJZZ in mid-November, before the Attorney General's petition, Bittersmith said that meeting was about the state broadband program and data.
Those are, I think, the general issues that were discussed. I can't precisely tell you what everybody said in every single instant, but that was the purpose of the meeting.
Broadband commonly refers to high-speed internet access that's carried using a variety of technologies, including DSL, cable modem, fiber, and wireless, and it can rely on the same delivery mechanisms as telephone.
They're often carried on the same pipes at some point. The services coalesce.
Mark Goldstein runs a consulting company and worked on the state's broadband plan. He describes Bittersmith and the cable industry's role in the broadband plan as...
They were quite active at the committee level in helping draft, in negotiating, but were not satisfied with not getting everything they wanted.
That plan was ultimately never adopted, and the council overseeing it stopped meeting by mid-2013. To this day, 80% of rural Arizona doesn't have a fast enough connection to meet the definition of broadband, according to recent federal numbers. Bittersmith says during this process, she was simply expressing the views of the cable industry, sometimes saying telecommunications because...
Telecommunications is one of those generic broad terms like Kleenex. It describes a lot of things that maybe are not part of it.
She says the commission does not have jurisdiction over broadband, so there's no issue. That includes voice over internet protocol, essentially web-based telephone that can travel on the telephone network. But according to the Attorney General's petition, some companies offering voice over IP are regulated by commission-approved tariffs, which set the maximum rates the companies can charge customers for voice over IP. From an infrastructure and business standpoint, some experts say broadband and telephone cannot be separated. Alan Hammond is a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law and director of the Broadband Institute of California.
If I have a corporation that has different divisions, it's all connected, I may have to operate my various divisions consistent with the law that governs that particular division.
As recently as this year, Bittersmith spoke about broadband during a policy discussion discussion called, quote, the role for regulators in an expanding broadband economy.
I personally see a lessening role in the regulatory side from elected officials, and perhaps more an opportunity for statewide regulators or policymakers to look at adoption programs and education programs.
When asked about those comments, Bittersmith said she was speaking about the need to jumpstart a conversation among policymakers in general, and not specifically commissioners. She says she was there in her capacity as a commissioner and cable industry spokesperson.
I think it was understood. I was certainly introduced in all of my various roles.
But according to the video of that discussion, the moderator introduces her as a commissioner, not as current director of the Cable Association. Bittersmith says she wears multiple hats, but like the rest of the commissioners, understands her constitutional responsibilities.
We're clear about what we are to do and what we are not to do and where the lines are drawn.
It's now up to the Arizona Supreme Court to determine whether she's crossed that line. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Coming up, Phoenix is working on a formal process for some downtown businesses to get liquor licenses.
What we've seen is with that density, there are certain businesses and certain spaces that are limited in their operation.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound. The exit ramp at 59th Avenue is restricted. Be aware of that situation. Also in the East Valley, 202 northbound, the Santan Freeway. A crash at Elliott has the shoulder blocked. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 64 degrees. It's warmer than yesterday, but still 5 degrees cooler than average. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows right around 40 degrees. Sunny skies for the next few days as well. Look for a high of 70 tomorrow, up to 75 by Thursday. Partly sunny skies, a high of 73 on Friday. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 22%, it's sunny and 58 degrees at 2:20.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Theater, presenting The Wizard of Oz through December 27th. Tickets to travel over the rainbow and down the yellow brick road at phoenixtheater.com.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, December 1st. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. It's not a techno fix, but it just might be good old-fashioned, low-tech, well-motivated behavior change in the numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention today. The number of new diabetes cases in the U.S. has finally started to fall.
The rate of new cases declined by a fifth between 2008 and 2014 for the first time in 25 years. Sabrina Tavernese, health reporter for our partner, The New York Times, says the numbers have surprised researchers, and deep in the numbers, there are some great stories of lives turned around.
This disease has been just exploding since the beginning of the 1990s. Researchers were very surprised. In fact, they sort of saw this kind of flattening out and weren't ready to sort of, you know, say that there was any type of decline going on. There had been increases for so many years that was what people were used to seeing.
And when you looked for the tangible results of this, and again, they're sketchy on cause and effect here, but nevertheless, you've found communities where behavior has changed things and that's had a real impact. Explain.
Yeah. In fact, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you think, health behaviors are going to be the same forever and, you know, we're just going to go on forever with bad diet and little exercise. But in fact, even in some of the poorest communities in the country, there'd been some real change. You know, people out on walking trails, people really trying to get their diet in a better place. I mean, and part of the reason is that, you know, this disease has been so devastating in so many of these places that, you know, you see around you your neighbors having leg amputations, and that's really motivating.
And that was the story in Alabama, where a family member's amputation really changed the behavior of a whole family.
That's exactly right. The daughter said, "I see my mother having to go to dialysis all the time. That's really not a life I want to have. I have to change things. I have to do it."
And in this case, she went from 50 cans a week to fewer than 7 cans of Coca-Cola. Walking, she lost 42 pounds. Did doctors say that is probably the reason why she has not developed full-blown type 2 diabetes?
Well, you know, doctors are doctors and they're always very careful. But, you know, they were really happy at how she was able to change her behavior. There's a, you know, there was a lot of soda drinking going on, particularly in the hot places in the United States, you know, a lot of Coca-Cola in the summer. And that's a huge adder of calories throughout the day. So cutting down on that was a big deal. And just sort of being much more cautious about how you cook and how you eat. And that was really happening down there. And again, because people see how devastating this disease has been in their communities. I mean, one of my people I interviewed was a woman who herself had diabetes, actually, but she was a medical van driver. And she said that some people had so many amputations that it looked like a shark had eaten them. I mean, it was a very, very vivid, quite terrifying, actually, image.
Has this scourge of diabetes mobilized people in terms of thinking about survival of their community? Is it purely personal fear? Does it have a relationship to the empowerment of this community much more broadly in the civil rights narrative?
It has. Certainly the health crisis there has really motivated people who, you know, are part of church networks or part of traditional Black networks of folks doing activism. So I think that in many ways, yes, you know, that people who had come together for issues of race do think of this diabetes crisis and the health crisis in some of these areas as a continuation of that fight in some ways.
Sabrina Tavernese is a health reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Phoenix officials are working on coming up with a formal process for downtown business owners applying for an exemption to the state's liquor laws. This June, the city council approved an entertainment district downtown that allows businesses to get liquor licenses even if they're within 300 feet of a school or church. For more on this, we turn to Anna Darian, a project management assistant in Phoenix's Community and Economic Development Department.
Historically, that's not really been a big concern, particularly as most of Phoenix is pretty suburban and we have a lot of space to have that separation. And really, for a lot of neighborhoods, that makes a lot of sense. What we've seen, particularly in downtown Phoenix, where we've had this amazing urban revival and we've got more people living downtown and businesses coming downtown, churches, schools, you name it, what we've seen is with that density, there are certain businesses and certain spaces that are limited in their operation. So we have, you know, different bars that wanted to pursue a liquor license, great spaces, old warehouses, amazing architecture right next to a church. And ultimately, they ended up going elsewhere. So we, when it came to the Community and Economic Development Department, there were about three businesses that were limited by this. And so they had asked us to look into this entertainment district.
So how does this entertainment district help address the issue that you were dealing with?
So a number of years ago, the Arizona State Legislature passed what's called an entertainment district, and it sounds like a lot. What this basically means in terms of liquor licenses is that the cities and towns in Arizona can now designate a space called an entertainment district, and within this space, a business can apply to be exempted from the separation. So it's not automatic. It's not by right. There would still be an opportunity for city council to weigh it and consider it before automatically approving it. And there would still be a public process. And that would happen all through this entertainment district legislation. And so the cities have opportunity to create this district, which we did in downtown Phoenix in June of this year.
So has that solved the problem then?
It has definitely solved the problem for a number of businesses. Yes, and we will continue to see applications. We know of a few more businesses that are still getting things worked out, and we expect to see some more applications. We've seen one so far, and we expect to see at least a couple more in the next couple years.
Why is it important for businesses to be able to get these kinds of liquor licenses?
Well, you know, with a downtown, it's really just part and parcel to a nightlife. Having the bars, having the theaters, having the music, having that nightlife, it's just, it's all part of that definition of what makes a vibrant downtown. Certainly, you know, folks are entitled to a lot of their opinions about that. But what we really found is that just having that opportunity for businesses to be considered, we could get to a place where everybody was content with that. And you know, this doesn't mean that it opens it up to where every type of business can come in. There's a lot of opportunities for public inputs. But really just nightlife and alcohol is just one of those things that makes a vibrant downtown.
Given that there's only one that has sought the exemption, how necessary was it to even do this district?
Well, certainly we don't know how many more businesses could potentially need this. I think also what this meant for downtown is just sort of it's following a lot of different policies and changes that we've done in the city that have really just made downtown Phoenix the place to be. And this just, we wanted to give the area as much opportunity as possible through whatever tools and policies that we have at our disposal. And the entertainment district was just one of so many other ways that we've wanted to support small businesses and you know, all businesses coming and looking to invest in Phoenix.
So is this more a matter of looking ahead as opposed to dealing with like a cry for this right now?
Well, there was certainly, you know, even having 2 to 3 businesses that are limited by this, it means a lot to us. You know, downtown is a pretty small, budding little ecosystem, but so we want to give everybody a fighting chance. And so that was all we really needed was just those 2 or 3. And if it grows, great. But, you know, for those few that needed it, it mattered to us to get that through.
Anna Darian is Project Management Assistant for Phoenix's Community and Economic Development Department. Anna, thank you.
Thank you.
The fight against the so-called Islamic State involves numerous countries and strategies, and the online activist group Anonymous claims to be taking on ISIS in social media. But can a loosely defined group of hackers really make much difference? The BBC's Becky Milligan begins with a researcher who's met several members of Anonymous.
Sometimes the name is used to fight ISIS, as is happening currently. In other instances, it is about fighting, calling out rape culture, police brutality, or assisting social movements around the world.
Gabriella Coleman, a professor of anthropology at McGill University in Montreal. She's written a book on the group and met several Anons, the name for members of Anonymous.
Lawyers, professors, janitors, Buddhists, drug addicts, ex-drug addicts, law students, homeless Anons. I mean, I've just been astounded.
Mustafa, an ex-Anon, joined when he was 15, and it's impossible to absolutely know for sure he was an Anon. He told me about the ops he was involved in.
For example, my involvement during the Arab Spring, when the revolutions and protests were going on, there was a lot of online censorship and surveillance, especially in Tunisia. So one of the things I did is I created a sort of script or program to try to overcome that censorship and prevent their communications from being surveilled by the government so that it can be more safe in their activism.
The declaration of war on so-called ISIS by Anonymous is a world away from the trolling and pranking for entertainment's sake. But they have been employing a familiar weapon in their arsenal, which must, at the very least, be annoying if someone is trying to watch jihadi propaganda and gets this instead. You know the rules, and so do I. They've been rickrolling ISIS.
Their hearts are in the right place.
Michael Smith, terrorism analyst and a co-founder of Cronus Advisory, a US defence contractor. He says Anonymous may have the best intentions.
There is definitely a need for more eyes on the targets. There's no question about that. FBI Director Comey has regularly stated this year that his people are overwhelmed. The Islamic State's presence online is prolific. And so there is room for outside support, but it needs to be coordinated with the officials who manage real counterterrorism casework. If you go out and you impress upon Twitter that they should be closing 10,000 accounts, which are believed to be utilized by the Islamic State's members and supporters, you're not only creating an effect that they can easily turn around and overcome by opening new accounts, you're potentially interfering with ongoing investigations.
So what you're actually saying is it might be better if some of these accounts stayed open because they might actually offer intelligence.
Exactly.
It's no wonder Anonymous has found support when we're faced with the horror of Paris and other atrocities. Anonymous published an online guide for inexperienced hackers to help join the fight. It's a cyber battle. Gabriella Coleman.
During my research, I did visit one intelligence organization, and the staff anthropologist did convey that some of the jihadists back in 2012 did admire Anonymous, you know, not so much for the types of targets that they were going after, but for their ability to create such wonderful online content. One of the interesting things is that on the one hand, they both use online channels for their propaganda, but at a certain juncture, they really diverge, and they diverge precisely in the content. ISIS was quite famous for creating and releasing these extremely violent and gruesome videos. Anonymous, on the other hand, basically releases videos of a masked man sitting at a desk, and I think most of the public can tell the difference.
We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
That story from the BBC's Becky Milligan. Still to come, trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the air after it's already been released.
We are arguing the most direct way and a faster way of dealing with the problem is to take the CO2 just like a tree, but more efficiently out of the air.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, accidents I-10 westbound at State Route 202. I-10 eastbound, the exit ramp at 59th Avenue still restricted there. And on the 202 Santan Freeway northbound, a crash at Elliott has the shoulder blocked. Sunny skies in the valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon. Continue below average high temperatures, though. We're looking for a high today of 64 degrees. 69 is average. We hit 61 yesterday. It'll be clear and cold tonight with overnight lows right around 40 degrees. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 70, up to 75 for a high on Thursday. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, 62 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Grebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. In news from KJZZ, an Arizona regulator wants the state's biggest utility to turn over campaign contribution records that could be linked to dark money in last year's election. KJZZ's Will Stone has more on the ongoing controversy involving Arizona Public Service and the Corporation Commission.
Writing that the public appears to look upon the commission with suspicion and mistrust, Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns called upon APS to disclose any spending on the 2014 election cycle. The demand comes in response to $3 million in alleged dark money contributions from the utility and its parent company to the campaigns of now Commissioners Tom Farese and Doug Little. Burns says he'd like to confirm APS only spent its profits on that and not, say, ratepayer dollars that should only be used to recover the costs of providing service. Earlier this year, Burns asked for the utility to voluntarily refrain from such contributions, but that was sharply rejected by the company's CEO, who argued that would muzzle its political speech. The company has not confirmed or denied whether it was behind the contributions in question last cycle. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Two candidates for Tucson City Council want a Pima County Superior Court judge to declare them the winners or order a do-over election. The city argues Kelly Lawton and Margaret Burkholder have no claim because Tucson operated the election following the rules laid out in the city charter. The judge may make a decision by next week and has to take action based on a split decision from a panel of three Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges that was issued a week after the November 3rd election. That ruling said Tucson's election system is in violation of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. The city is petitioning for a rehearing of the case by a larger panel of Ninth Circuit judges. Phoenix Mart is facing another controversy. A couple of weeks ago, the Phoenix Business Journal reported on an FBI raid and investigation. And now the paper says there are reports Phoenix Mart's parent company misled Chinese investors about the project's potential risk. If it's built, Phoenix Mart would be part of a 500-acre multi-use development in Casa Grande, the anchor of which is an expo center containing rentable showrooms for manufacturers and buyers. The development is funded by a program through U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services known as EB-5. Eric J. Toll has been covering all of this for the Phoenix Business Journal and says that plays a role in what's been happening.
The EB-5 program is designed to encourage foreign direct investment by allowing foreigners to invest $1 million and create 10 jobs. If they do that, they get a green card for themselves and their family. But they have to spend that money on the capital project and create the 10 jobs within 2 years. And apparently, that two-year period is coming up. I was told by a source that the FBI was raiding them based on accusations of investor fraud. Then I got a copy of a story from the Epoch Times, which is a Chinese language newspaper that covers the world. And they had talked with a immigration specialist in Los Angeles who was dealing with at least one Chinese family that was here on the conditional visa who had their permanent visa green card turned down. And he started investigating it. And what he told the reporter for the Epoch Times is that there are different promotional materials in China than those that are being generated in the U.S. Now, the Phoenix Smart folks say that to their knowledge, all the materials are the same.
Is Phoenix Smart producing these materials or is it outsourcing them to someone else?
I can't speak to what's going on in China, but here in Phoenix, they're producing the materials here. And, of course, they have to conform to immigration and securities regulations on disclosures. The thing about the EB-5 program is that many times the investors are not as interested in getting a return on their investment as they are in getting the green cards.
Is there any evidence that Chinese citizens have invested in Phoenix Smart thinking that it's a pretty safe investment and have lost their money?
Nobody's lost their money yet because my understanding is the money has to be escrowed. The Chinese article was really pushing the point about some of these EB-5 investments have gone sour for Chinese investors, but they've gotten their permanent green cards. And the implication in the Epoch Times story is that essentially people are spending $1 million
to
get a green card for their family.
Have you found that there have been similar discrepancies, let's call them, in advertisements in places other than China?
Well, with Phoenix Smart, the promotional materials and in an interview last year with Elizabeth Mann, which she said, she was the CEO, she said that all of her investors in that project are from China. But there have been other soured EB-5 projects around the country, most notably one very similar to Phoenix Smart in Chicago near O'Hare Airport.
Did it seem like, from reading the Epoch Times and talking to the reporter who wrote it, that the differences in the English language and Chinese language promotional material was more than just sort of something lost in translation?
That's what the immigration specialist told the reporter for Epoch Times. And she and I talked about that yesterday, that the materials are distinctly different. Again, the people at Phoenix Smart specifically told me that to their knowledge, all the materials are the same, whether they're in Chinese being distributed in the People's Republic or in English here in the U.S.
Eric J. Toll is a reporter for the Phoenix Business Journal. He's been covering the Phoenix Smart controversies that have been going on with that project. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency says in 2013, carbon dioxide, or CO2, accounted for more than 80% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. But researchers at ASU are working on a way to take CO2 out of the air. Klaus Lackner is the director of the University Center for Negative Carbon Emissions.
One thing you could do is you could grow a lot of trees, a lot of biomass, and then burn it and deal with the CO2 and dispose of it. We are arguing the most direct way and a faster way of dealing with a problem is to take the CO2 just like a tree, but more efficiently out of the air.
So how do you do that?
Well, we have developed, or discovered is probably the better word, a material which has the remarkable property that if it's dry, It really likes CO2. It binds it. And when you make it wet in a closed box, it will release that CO2 and give it back. So as a result, we can stand out here in the nice desert air in the sunshine, and as the wind blows over our leaves of an artificial tree, so to speak, the CO2 binds to these surfaces. Then we gather them, put them in a box, make them wet, and then the CO2 comes off at a few percent CO2 in the gas mixture which comes out of that box. We now can feed this to algae, or we could collect it and turn it into mineral carbonates and put it permanently and safely away. The third option is we could have sunshine on a photovoltaic panel which makes electricity. With that electricity, we break up water and make hydrogen. With that hydrogen and CO2, we can make fuel again. So we close the cycle that way.
So what is this material that it sounds like it's basically like a magnet for carbon dioxide?
Your classical magnet for carbon dioxide is a sodium hydroxide solution or even a sodium carbonate solution. If you put CO2 over those solutions, you can collect CO2. What we have is the same idea inside a plastic.
How would you go about deploying these? I mean, what would they look like? Where would you put them? How many would you need?
Well, we like to think about them as ultimately factory produced because we know, let's say, from building cars, how effective it is to mass produce, how cheap things can get if you do this. And so we see containerized units, so they fit in a standard shipping container, and they can probably in the end pull out about 1 ton per day. And if you had that many and you wanted to deal with all the CO2 we create right now, which is unlikely that we do it that way, but if you did, you would need 100 million of them. Keep in mind, we have 1 billion cars parked somewhere, so that number is large, but not as large as that it's prohibitive.
Do you think that philosophically, is there almost kind of a danger in this kind of technology that if people think, well, it doesn't matter how much I emit because these machines can just take it out of the atmosphere and it won't matter what I do?
Well, I've thought about that a lot. I think the first answer is you could have told me this in 1980 and I would have agreed with you. Right now, you're telling me to fight a very big problem with one hand tied behind my back. In a way, I think it's already too late. It's very likely that we will reach a level in the atmosphere which is higher than we can afford. So we need this technology. Now, whether it will lead people to say, well, now we can keep using the carbon dioxide, at the very least, I can come back and say it didn't cause climate change because we actually did balance the books, and I can leave it to the markets to figure out what is right. On the other hand, keep in mind, putting that CO2 away will cost money. And you will actually emphasize technologies which avoid doing it in the first place. Right? I'm not supposed to put my garbage right on the street and scatter it everywhere, and that's effectively what we do with CO2. But my garbage truck coming by also has written down in big letters, reduce, reuse, recycle. And in a way, the simple fact that you say, if you didn't recycle it, if you didn't reuse it, it has to go into the landfill. You start thinking about, how can I make it better? And I think we are still thinking about carbon dioxide as something, oh, if we did less of it, it's a good thing. You wouldn't think of this with my waste. If I say I figured out how to only dump half of my garbage onto the street, you wouldn't think that's a good idea. Right? You would say that half still has to be put away. Of course, because it costs money to put it in the landfill, I'm now very much paying attention of making less waste. And I think that's how we have to think about CO2.
Klaus Lackner is director of ASU Center for Negative Carbon Emissions. Klaus, thank you.
You're welcome.
World leaders are meeting in Paris to try to hash out a deal on climate change. More than 150 governments have already drawn up detailed pledges to curb emissions of greenhouse gases. Among the country's volunteering targets is Malawi in East Africa, one of the poorest nations in the world. The BBC's Roger Harabin reports on some innovative energy plans.
Welcome to Balaka region, Malawi. This is a tribute song to a cook stove. Almost everyone in Malawi cooks with wood or with charcoal. Malawi's greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels are minuscule, but felling forests to burn wood harms the climate. Here, local women are making cook stoves that halve the amount of wood needed to cook dinner. Project organiser Doreen Puanda Puanda says the stoves also reduce the smoke that harms women.
Most of the women's songs are about the cook stoves. In Chichewa, we call them Chitetezo Mbaula. The name Chitetezo means protection, that it protects them from a lot of things, like smoke that is a hazard to their health.
So stoves like these clearly make an important contribution, but just round the corner, there's an even more ingenious idea. Here's a little miracle in front of our eyes. There's one of the completed stoves. Bolted onto the outside of the stove is a remarkable little contraption. It's a little square chimney which is filled with water. And from the chimney is a lead leading to a circuit board. And there are mobile phones plugged into the end. This is a generator that generates electricity through heat, whilst also cooking your dinner. It's called a thermoelectric generator. It makes power from the heat differential between two metals. The project's done by the UK charity Concern Universal. In its pledge to the coming climate conference in Paris, Malawi promises to spread the clean cook stoves, which are currently supported through British and Irish aid. As part of the deal, Malawi's also asking for cash from rich nations to get more solar power and to replant its forests. Outside experts applaud its climate pledge, but raise doubts about its institutional ability to fulfil it, given the scale of the energy needed.
We have a power cut. Everything is stopped.
Mohamed Amin Natani owns Kukoma Cooking Oils in the commercial capital of Malawi, Blantyre. Like almost everyone else in the country, they've faced power cuts as the electricity grid struggles to meet demand.
Literally, we're on standstill. Our packing department is stopped, our refineries are closed, our crushing plants are closed, our offloading of the trucks stops, everything stops. Because once the mills stop, everything starts to come to a chocker.
Mohammed now has his power back, at least for the moment, but others have been cut off instead. Malawi's creaking hydroelectric system supplies almost all the country's electricity, but it's just not enough, especially given a population boom that keeps raising energy demand. Part of the government's solution is to build two new coal-fired power plants. Environmentalists say if poor countries use coal to help them develop, it'll lock the world into high carbon emissions for decades. Malawi's saying it's not being offered any other good option.
8 minutes to...
1, 2, 3... 6-year-old Rachel shows the scale of the problem. In her one-room village home, her little face is framed in a halo of light from a small solar lamp. Her maths grades have gone up since her mum bought the lamp under a scheme promoted by British aid. But it is the only light in this village, in the pitch black of the African night. Everyone else says light is unaffordable.
That's the BBC's Roger Harabin in Malawi. Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Sunny skies, 62 degrees at KJZZ at 2:53.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where cancer specialists work together to provide personalized care right here in Metro Phoenix. More at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
When you think about the valley and a spot that gives you a sense of place for the valley, what is it? Why does it give you that sense? These are questions we're posing to Valley Architects in a series we're calling In a Place. And I'm joined now by Christina Noble of Contour Architecture. We're at 40th Street and Campbell in Phoenix at Le Grand Orange, otherwise known as LGO. Christina, what is it about this spot that gives you a sense of place for the valley?
What I love about it is the really sort of neighborhood feeling that you have here, right? So I'll come here and I'll run into people that I know almost all the time. It's set within the neighborhood as opposed to maybe, you know, a larger complex at 32nd Street and Camelback, which we also frequent. I live nearby. And there you have, you know, kind of your traditional strip mall, giant sea of parking that sits out in front. And you might have a cool restaurant inside, but you really can't, it's hard to detect that from the outside. Whereas at a place like LGO, it's small enough and intimate enough that you can really kind of tell, you know, even from the street, like, wow, there's something fantastic going on here. It's set in a neighborhood in which you have smaller streets, and so a great way for me to spend a Saturday with my son and my husband is to ride our bikes down here. There's a little park just down the street. We'll hit the park at the same time. And so it really becomes a part of, the local community and the neighborhood, and that's part of what I love about it.
So you mentioned smaller streets. There's not a ton of parking right in front of us, and the street is right over there. Is that part of what gives you the sense that this is part of the neighborhood, that it's not sort of hidden within a sea of parking and behind a lot of other stuff?
Yes, absolutely. I think the fact that, you have people who live close by who choose to walk here, that definitely makes it more a part of this local neighborhood. The same is true myself, right? I bike over instead of parking. And I know a lot of people will disagree with me, but the fact that parking is inconvenient actually adds to that sense of character. Because you don't have a giant sea of asphalt in front of the building, you do feel like there's something a little bit more exciting. It's more accessible.
Do you think that there are other neighborhoods in the Phoenix area in which a place like this would work? Because I don't think it would necessarily work everywhere in Phoenix.
So you definitely see it in a lot of the older neighborhoods in Phoenix, right? And there's other places that we know that have a similar quality, like the Windsor Churn complex as well. So you're seeing it in other neighborhoods, and it does tend to happen in some of the older neighborhoods of Phoenix. And it's also happening, not even in Phoenix specifically, right? Like, you'll see it in places like Mesa or Gilbert that are trying to accomplish, or Chandler that are trying to accomplish a similar quality.
Do you think that the fact that there is something like this in Phoenix, when there are other kinds of things like this in other places around the country, is that a sign, do you think, of Phoenix's sort of evolution, maybe away from strip malls and that kind of development, to stuff more like this on a slightly smaller scale?
Absolutely, yes. And you do see it in other cities, and of course, we want it here too. And so we kind of end up with our own version of it that's still going to have that kind of quality that does make it particular to Phoenix.
When you look around here, other than seeing the mountain in the distance, there's not a ton of desert landscaping around here. You don't see a lot of cactuses. You don't see a lot of gravel. There's grass. There are big old trees here. And I think for a lot of people, that doesn't really say Phoenix. So I'm wondering, if you weren't as familiar with this neighborhood as you are and you didn't live nearby, do you still think that this area would sort of be able to give you a sense of place and say, yeah, this is Phoenix to me?
Well, I mean, I guess, yeah. So maybe, knowing a little bit of that history, right? The fact that Phoenix did start as an agrarian community. This particular part of town actually started as citrus groves. We're close to the Arcadia neighborhood, which originated in 1919. And, and at that time, they actually specifically put in irrigation so that those properties could continue to farm if they wanted to, even though it was a residential subdivision. And so the fact that you do still have a lot of that citrus, maybe it's more particular to this specific neighborhood within Phoenix. And that is a contrast to the specific desert. And it's kind of an interesting contrast, too, when you think about the kind of, the citrus trees versus the mountain in the distance. And it can be quite, quite beautiful.
Christina Noble is an architect with Contour Architecture. Christina, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to know what gives you a sense of place for the Valley. Tell us your spot. Tweet it at us at KJZZPhoenix using the hashtag KJZZInAPlace. Well, the place to be tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock is in front of your radio or in front of a computer that's streaming KJZZ, because you can listen to KJZZ's Here and Now. Its host, Steve Goldstein, is here. And Steve, pretty big name guest you've got tomorrow.
Ann Romney, the wife of Mitt Romney, is going to be joining us, Mark. She has a new book out about her struggles and fights with multiple sclerosis and the research she's doing and that she's funding to help try to find a cure for it.
What else should we be listening for?
We're going to be talking about the protests on college campuses. There have been some controversial columns and articles saying, do kids who protest on college campuses really know what they're doing? And we'll hear from both sides.
All right, that's that and much more tomorrow morning at 11, KJZZ's Here and Now. The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revizova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas. You can find us at the show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. All Things Considered is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mountain States Employers Council, providing businesses with HR support and employment's law assistance, focusing on critical matters such as hiring and firing, workplace harassment, and the Affordable Care Act, msec.org.